Welcome to Behavioral Health Businesses Perspectives Podcast. I'm Laura Lovett, Senior Editor at Behavioral Health Business, and your host for this episode. For this month's podcast, I'm sitting down with Rupert McCormick, CEO of Crossroads. I spoke with Rupert about the organization's growth strategy, navigating the challenging regulatory landscape, and the shift towards value-based care. Hi, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's a privilege to be on here. I think a lot about the work you guys do and appreciate everything you're putting out there about the industry.
Thank you. Let's just start off. Could you tell me a little bit about Crossroads?
Sure. Yeah, I'll start by saying I'm Rupert McCormick, founder and CEO of Crossroads. I'm a psychiatrist by education and training and started the company right at 20 years ago, back in 2005, with a real focus on being the best outpatient healthcare provider we can be to those suffering for substance use disorder, with a keen focus on outcomes and producing the best possible outcomes for everyone suffering from substance use disorder. It has gone from one location in 2005 to now having the privilege to have spread access to over 100 locations across 9 states and have just over 1,000 great teammates helping me get it all done.
Great. Let's talk a little bit about some recent news. Crossroads recently acquired Family Health Services. Can you walk me through the strategic rationale behind the acquisition and how does that sort of fit into your broader growth strategy?
Yeah, gladly. We've had the privilege and opportunity to do a number of those types of tuck-in acquisitions, if you will. And Family Health Services happened to be in Pennsylvania, which is a really important state to us. We have really good payer relationships there and have been able to create really what I will call industry-leading value-based contracts that actually reward for quality outcomes. And so when we come across quality providers like Family Health Services, it creates a unique opportunity to build on the great work they're already doing and overlay some of the work Crossroads has invested heavily in that creates these outcomes that we think are special and industry-leading and unique. So to answer your question directly, it fits perfectly and squarely within our strategy, which is to always put the patients first, have a clinical model that is industry leading, and be able to produce outcomes and show those outcomes off to patients, providers, and payers, and have a really special situation on our hands. So those two locations have been integrated at this point and are up and running, and it's been a really nice success story.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to talk a little bit about your larger growth strategy. How do you think about, M&A and even de novo? And how do you think about what market to approach, when to go in? How does that kind of work at Crossroads?
Yeah, we're quite focused on filling in density in the states that we already operate in through a de novo process. That tends to make a good bit of sense, and then also execute on some of the tuck-in acquisitions like the one we just mentioned with FHS in Pennsylvania. So it's a little bit of a hybrid strategy within our current footprint, as we already have the infrastructure in those states to support either a tuck-in acquisition or a de novo. So we're currently doing that work and actively opening up de novos, largely on the, well, actually singularly on the OBOT side with regards to de novos, and then the small tuck-ins on the acquisition side. Now, if we want to enter a new state or we have very little density in that state, then a larger acquisition could make sense. And we do not like de novo our way into a new state. It's really done through acquisition. So that's really our radar right now, is looking at what states make the most sense and then looking to see if there's a really quality patient first, high quality clinical model operator out there. And then we would diligence that heavily and enter the state through that pathway, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. You know, kind of changing gears and talking about new initiatives. Last year, you implemented a new measurement-based care model. What drove that decision and how has that kind of transformed your clinical approach and patient outcomes?
Yeah, this is near and dear to us, and we've been doing it really now almost a full 2 years. It's very much in line with our vision statement, which is to be the most convenient, comprehensive, highest quality operator out there. And when I say, I'll just touch on that third one, highest quality, that means to us, it means a disciplined adherence to evidence-based approaches, which is how I was trained by my mentor, Steve Merlin. And it's how we've operated from day one. And so measurement-based care is a clear winner on the evidence-based approach front. And for anyone listening who doesn't know what it is, I'll do a quick description of it, or at least what it is to Crossroads. So when we say measurement-based care, we mean real-time measurement-based care, which is this. We send digital health screens out to each and every one of our patients via text link. They can click on it with their thumb. It's a clinically validated instrument. They can fill it out within usually 3 to 5 minutes. And the results of that digital health screen get imported into a provider dashboard that we're monitoring around the clock. And we have a centralized team of interventionalists that are monitoring the scores of those various digital health screens. And when a score exceeds the threshold, we will reach out to that patient and ask them if there's anything they need, or, you know, inquire as to what's going on, depending on what digital health screen it is and what the score was. And we can reach out via text or phone. We do thousands and thousands of those every month as far as outreach. And it's really potent and it's really impactful to their lives, in that we believe life happens between visits. Rarely does it happen during the visit. So the visit is very important to us, and we accomplish a lot during that visit. But obviously, from a time perspective, the vast majority of your life happens outside of that medical visit. And so these digital health screens are helping us gather real-time data about our patients and intervening before that patient has further declined. So if their urge to use screen, for example, is peaking, meaning they might be having cravings or urges, then we need to call them and text them. And we do, and we find out, you know, are they without their prescription? Or is there something going on that's stressful in their life? And that can literally keep them from going to the ER or getting admitted inpatient or going to the ICU, which is how we drive a lot of our outcomes. So we're really proud of this. We've actually done millions of these digital health screens. We did over 600,000 last year. So we have reams of data on our patients, and it helps us not only interact in real time, but also predict to some degree what our patients might be struggling with the most. And this measurement-based care practice of ours has allowed us to truly produce outcomes that are really, really exceptional. So yeah, we're proud of this one.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to kind of dig deeper into this a little bit and ask you how that measurement-based care model has really impacted your relationships with payers. You know, are there any concrete results that you've been able to demonstrate and give those payers?
Yeah, absolutely. It really changed the course of Crossroads. I'm sure, given your depth of knowledge about our space, you know, there are a lot of providers struggling. And a lot of that has to do with how our industry is set up with regards to payment structures. And a lot of it is still what I would call a bastardized fee-for-service structure, which is perhaps rewarding people for volume and not quality. And that is the opposite of what Crossroads is about. We only want to be paid for quality outcomes for our patients. And so our ability to execute on measurement-based care, actually pipe this data that emanates from the digital health screens through a proper enterprise data warehouse and visualize the data, and then demonstrate that data and show it off to the point of your question, and in this case, to the payers, has been transformative. And what I mean by that is it's allowed us to now convert over 60% of our census on to true value-based contracts. And I want to say what I mean by that, because a lot of people talk about value-based care and contracts and it becomes a buzzword. And so I want to be very clear about what I'm talking about with over 60% of our contracts. These are value-based contracts that have a bundle associated with them, which is, I believe, a really nice, proper way to reimburse for the services that someone like Crossroads delivers on. But also there's a bonus upside performance to it based on outcomes. So mandating that the patient gets what they needed and the outcomes that they deserve, and the payer then sees those outcomes, then we get a bonus. And it's our ability to collect the data, produce the data, demonstrate it, and actually execute on those value-based contracts that transformed our way of operating, because now we can provide services that didn't have a code associated with it. We don't want to operate based on billing because we want to operate based on what the patient needs. And that's the way we've always done it. And now we're getting rewarded for it. And I can give examples of that. I mean, care management is probably one of the best examples. Or measurement-based care. You know, there can be codes out there that might attempt to reimburse for things like that, but that's not what we're about. We like the idea of a bundle with this performance bonus that actually allows us to do treatment when and where works best for the patient, no matter what it is. So these care managers can help patients find shoes for their kids. They can help connect them with primary care. They can help connect them with our virtual mental health model. They can help them with the number of their unmet social needs. You know, 70% of our patients have one or more serious unmet social needs, including food insecurity, housing insecurity, interpersonal safety, transportation issues. So that's how it changed everything for us.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of folks in the SED industry are talking about value-based care, but really not in value-based care arrangements right now. What advice would you give other folks in the SUD industry who are curious about dipping their toes into value-based care contracts?
Yeah, I would just say that the investment in this is a little boring, this part, but the investment in a proper enterprise data warehouse and the ability to integrate your system such that you can collect data and then report, visualize and report out on it. That in and of itself is quite transformative, but it's like a mandatory capability. Now, how do you get the data? Well, that's the measurement-based care. You know, the real-time practice of measurement-based care is driving that. And then so as far as advice, it's like, all jokes aside, but like pick the states you operate in carefully and form really good relationships with the payers based on treating their members with the best care possible. And it's like, we've just always found that to be true. If we just do the right thing for the patients, the results follow. And then other people see the value in that, including payers. So I think it's just like nail your clinical model, have the system set up, and then be good at a good, decent human at maintaining relationships.
Yeah, no, that makes so much sense. And I think, you know, sometimes we take that technology element and being able to collect data for granted. And there's so many providers that don't have that ability, especially in the behavioral health realm. So it's a really interesting building block.
Yeah, that's right. It requires a significant upfront investment. And that's one of the things going back to the first question you asked about. One of the first questions you asked about was FHS and how those acquisitions fit into our thesis. And this is one of the things we can bring to operators like that. They're already doing amazing quality work because they have passionate providers doing evidence-based medication-assisted treatment, et cetera. But what they don't have the capability of necessarily doing is true real-time measurement-based care or having a 24/7 access center like we do, or to be able to pipe their data in and visualize it and get under a value-based contract. And then that allows then the care managers, right, to come in and address these unmet social needs. And then we can overlay our virtual mental health offering, which over 60% of our patients, by the way, have a mental health issue. So we're able to address that. So it all fits together quite nicely.
Yeah. I mean, on top of, you know, value-based care arrangements, I know that Crossroads has had a lot of other innovations in the space as well. Previously, you've worked on contingency management in the past. Is that something you still find useful? And are there other innovative treatment models that you're interested in?
Yeah, the contingency management model is another great evidence-based approach. We did it originally through Pear Therapeutics, who had a really nice digital health therapeutic, as you know, Resetto. And that was a great tool. We rolled it out. Patients loved it. Providers loved it. And we saw some really great outcomes. Now, unfortunately, that model didn't work out in that case. And so we no longer have that tool available. But we are big supporters and fans of contingency management. But with the dissolution, I'll say, of Pear Therapeutics, we are currently not doing contingency management in that way. Now, you could say, well, there's many forms of contingency management, and there is, right? We have over 20 opiate treatment programs, and in those programs, patients are rewarded with phase exceptions and takeouts and other kind of therapeutic privileges that are earned through recovery achievements. But that's really contingency management in its lightest sense, in my opinion. The one I think the contingency management you're referring to is a much more powerful, potent, reward-driven system across many treatment modalities. And it's certainly something we support, but we're not currently doing.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. You know, I want to look a little bit at the regulatory environment. Obviously, a lot going on today. From Medicaid and Medicare, there's a lot of changes. There's also a lot of changes with health parity enforcement and telehealth policies. What developments do you see having the most significant impact on the SUD industry in the next 2 to 3 years?
Well, no surprise, we've been staying very close through Crossroads as a company, but also through a couple of industry groups that we belong to Big Beautiful Bill and everything that is emanating from that or will emanate from that. So when you say kind of things that we're concerned about or have our eye on, I would point to that as some of the most recent legislation that we've been keenly tuned into. And I can be specific with that in that, you know, that the idea of more frequent redeterminations is a real challenge for, I'll say, our patients, but I think our country as a whole. And it's not that I'm for or against Big Beautiful Bill. It's not what it's about. We've always taken the approach of just meet people where they're at. And if that's where we're at as a government and a country, that's fine. We'll address it. It's just like we did post-COVID with mass redetermination. So we will re-stand up our capability, which was to help patients very closely with their redetermination. And, I liken it to like you or I trying to go into the DMV and navigate our way through all the paperwork necessary. I think I've been rejected almost every time I go in there. I never have the right form, right? So it's like we really have to help our patients make sure they understand that process and help them through it. And we'll also want to work with states individually as that rolls out to what are the best systems to help support that, and what are the best ways we can address that so that we all get the outcome we want. So that's certainly one of them. The work requirement is another one, you know, we're looking at that right now as we understand it, and we're told in the Big Beautiful Bill, if you're in substance use disorder treatment, then you could get an exception and you'll maintain your Medicaid coverage. But we just want to make sure that we understand how that works administratively and be as effective as possible at supporting our patients in that pursuit as well. So those are a couple. And I think you mentioned some telehealth stuff, and that's another one that certainly gets talked about a lot. You know, the DEA has continued to renew this exception where patients can be seen purely virtual. And I'm not sure how long that'll be sustained, but the way Crossroads operates is a hybrid model. So we have these 100 locations where we see everyone in person, but we certainly do thousands of virtual appointments as well for patients that are having a struggle. And I can be specific with that, but this gets back to our vision statement of being the most convenient, comprehensive, highest quality. This fits squarely under convenience and helping support the patient. If someone can't get childcare to come to their appointment and it's easier for them to be seen for home for a follow-up visit, well, we'll just patch them in and do it virtually. So it's just about meeting the patients where they're at and what works best for them. So those are like a few of the regulatory things and kind of how we view the world.
Yeah. I mean, actually kind of going back to eligibility, how do you work with patients on that? Do you have staff members who are dedicated to that? I know you mentioned, after COVID, the redeterminations, are you thinking you'll go back to some of those models? What's kind of in place to help patients to make sure that the folks who are eligible are able to kind of get back into the system?
Yeah, that's a good one. So we have over 70 care managers at Crossroads that help with issues like this. So we stand ready to address that because, to be clear, and you know this, but to anyone that's not aware, that, you know, redetermination happens I'll just say constantly, because it's a rolling enrollment. And depending on when that member or patient has enrolled, their redetermination time may be up. And so we're very used to dealing with this and assisting our patients with this. Our 70 care managers are spectacular, and they do very important work on the unmet social need front and a myriad of other topics. And this is just one of them. Now, if it gets more intense, to 3 times a year where you're doing redetermination and the burden is very high, then we will restand up some of the capability we had post-COVID, which is a more centralized team that's available 24/7 for those calls from either care managers needing support or patients needing support on navigating certain intricacies of that redetermination process. So right now we stand ready, but if it becomes more cumbersome, we will restand up our post-COVID situation.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. You know, kind of shifting gears a little bit to talk about workforce operations, you know, the behavioral health industry for a very long time has seen significant staffing challenges. How is Crossroads addressing that, you know, with different recruitment, retention efforts, especially in those clinical roles?
Yeah, we've been very blessed in this regard in that, we have nearly 200, I'll say prescribers, that could be MDs, NPs, PAs, and then, the remainder to the 1,000 teammates I mentioned are various disciplines. But talking about providers for a moment or prescribers, we're just very fortunate in that the people that have joined Crossroads tend to be very mission-focused, very passionate individuals who sought out this space to operate in. And these are providers from ERs, we have OBGYNs, we have primary care physicians. Yes, we have psychiatrists and addictionologists, but the vast majority are not psychiatrists and addiction specialists. They're actually passionate providers who went on to get specialized training in the area that we operate in addition to the training we give. And they're here because they love what they do. They love seeing patients get their lives back, and they like doing it in an environment that has this culture, which, is really very, very important to Crossroads. We talk a lot about our clinical model, and we talk a lot about our culture. And the culture, I believe, is what retains the folks you're talking about, our 1,000 great teammates. When I was in training, I had a great mentor, as I mentioned maybe earlier, Steve Merlin, and one of the things he taught me was just to be true to your genuine, authentic culture. And that's what we've done from center one. That was our biggest difference. I actually thought the biggest difference Crossroads was going to have on day one in 2005 was the fact that we were the country's first Suboxone-only OTP. And I thought, well, this is going to be interesting because I know Suboxone works. I learned that from my mentor. And maybe it'll give them an alternative to methadone if they need it. And that was like, mild to moderately interesting. But what was transformative, and the reason I kept opening centers, is what I saw is the culture made the difference. When people walked in, we treated them with respect and empathy. And we've always told people, I would always tell everyone who walked in, and we do this today, we're glad you're here. And they're like, wow, no one's glad I'm anywhere. I haven't heard that in years. And I'm like, well, we're very glad you're here. And that's just part of the stigma that we have to improve. And so it was really emanating of respect and empathy, along with the rest of our Inspire culture, which was being intuitive, nurturing, speaking out loud about what we're doing, operating with a keen sense of perception about what the patient may need, a good sense of inner team dependence, working together, nurses, physicians, pharmacists, counselors, front desk workers, everyone working together, coupled with respect and empathy. That's really been our secret sauce, if you will. It's like humans, great humans treating great humans.
Yeah. And actually, a part of the workforce I wanted to dig into, and I just find really interesting, is peers. What do you see as the role of peers as part of your workforce? And then, do you think that role could be changing going forward? Or what do you see around that?
Yeah, I think the certified peer support specialist, and there's different titles in different states, but that's the one I'll use today, is a very, very important workforce. And for those that aren't super familiar, these are folks with shared lived experiences who are very passionate, and they're trained and educated and very well positioned to help folks, because I think this is certainly worth talking about, that You know, this country has built a lot of access. You know, you'll hear that we don't have enough access. I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that. Maybe we do need more access. But I'll tell you what we're very focused on is, okay, we've got these 100 locations, but how do you engage people that are struggling, that have real stress and a lot going on in their lives? How do you engage them to a degree where they can actually stay in treatment and prioritize their health care? And this gets to our mission statement, right? It's, you know, we exist to improve health equity to create superior outcomes for those with substance use disorder. Well, this gets to that health equity piece, you know, and it's really health inequity is what's going on, is people that need resources are not being given resources. And so we're here to provide those resources and support tools to help get through the life's difficulties so you can prioritize healthcare, because life is constantly getting in the way of people prioritizing their health. So these peer support specialists can be instrumental in engagement from the day a patient is admitted. We can attach a peer to them and engage. Text is a great way, but they can also do phone calls. But we have found text messaging to be very effective. It's just a touch base with someone who's been there. They've been through what you've been through, and they get it. Because, you know, when someone's admitted, they don't necessarily trust the healthcare system. In many ways, the healthcare system might have not been the best thing for them in the past. Maybe it has led to some of their problems, or certainly contributed. And so we really work with these peer support specialists to build trust with the patients, engagement, and try to retain them so that they can get stable enough to stay in treatment, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, definitely. You know, you mentioned text messaging there, but I'd love to kind of dig into some other technologies that Crossroads has used to maybe improve patient engagement or treatment adherence. How are you thinking about technology and implementation?
Yeah, well, I don't want to overcome maybe the most potent technology there, which is the one you just mentioned, which is texting. And I know it's not sexy and it's not particularly innovative, but we have found it to be by far and away the most effective way to communicate with the people we serve. And that is who we deeply care about. So text messaging has been transformative in the way of, well, let's go back to measurement-based care for a second. It's a great way to send a quick digital link to a clinically validated instrument, collect real-time data, and intervene with that patient in real time in a way that doesn't disrupt their life, in a way that's completely compatible with our vision statement of being convenient and comprehensive and high quality. So I think texting is our number one technology. So I kind of like to brag we're a low-tech enabled healthcare company, and that is what we are. Now, I certainly we can sit here and talk about AI, and I have some trepidation about even using the term, because there's a lot of buzzword stuff that goes on as soon as you bring up AI, but I'll talk about it. Yeah. We do have some, I suppose what we would say, AI capabilities. And one of them is, it is singularly targeted at being more convenient for our patients. So when they call our access center, the 24/7 access center we have, a lot of times it's to reschedule an appointment because, again, life is busy and you need to reschedule an appointment. Well, we don't need them to be on hold. We want to treat them and respond to them immediately. And so we have a nice AI functionality that's able to allow them to simply reschedule their appointments without even ever having to talk to a human or be in any sort of hold queue. And they love it. It's very convenient. It's easy to use. You can do it via text or phone call. So that's just like a quick, easy example. Another one that we're implementing, well, we're vetting still actually, but we will implement this year, is a commonly talked about one, which is, I'll call it an AI scribe. Our providers are fantastic. They want to spend more time with the patients, looking at them eye to eye, as opposed to typing on a keyboard into the EHR. And so we're very excited about choosing the right AI scribe to help our providers feel more rewarded and spend less time on the administrative side, but also first and foremost to help our patients feel even more connected and feel that respect and empathy from our providers, because they can just have a conversation and the documentation is taken care of. So maybe those are a few examples of like the AI receptionist, the AI scribe, but I will go back to saying the most important one we have is text messaging.
Yeah, no, that makes so much sense. And even, you know, I don't think I write about technology and healthcare all the time, and I don't think I've gotten any texts from doctors. So I think that's something still for many is something of the future.
That's really interesting, right? You know, we do texting in a number of ways with measurement-based care, I've already said, but also very importantly, just appointment reminders, you know, 4 days out, 2 days out, 24 hours out, the day of, and then if they miss their appointment for whatever reason that, you know, life has thrown at them, we will do no-show text messaging to re-engage them and tell them it's okay and like just, you know, respond to the text and we'll help them figure out in a very convenient manner, a time that might work for them, whether it's virtual or in person, just meet them where they're at. So the text messaging has there's so many different ways you can use it, but it has been central to our ability to engage patients even deeper.
Yeah, no, it makes so much sense. You know, kind of closing us out here, what's next for Crossroads? Anything you're looking at coming down the pipeline?
Yeah. So what's next for us is continuing to build on our value-based contracting relationships with payers because it allows us to provide more and more services when and where works best for the patient. So building out more and more of the VBC relationships across each of the states that we operate in. That's of a large focus for us. And continuing to build out our clinical model. We will put up our clinical model against anyone and the outcomes it produces, but we can always do more. And so, you know, we stay unsatisfied. We stay driven to deliver more. Right now, we deliver on SUD services. We deliver both directly and indirectly on solving for unmet social needs through our over 70 care managers. We have a virtual mental health capability for the over 60% of patients who have a mental illness that are under our care. This is really great. And we're treating hepatitis C directly. But for 70% of our patients, believe it or not, they have six or more serious physical health comorbidities. And these are very serious physical health comorbidities, including infectious disease and other serious illnesses that need to be treated. And they've been deprioritized because our patients have been very busy and stressed. And so one of the things we want to focus on is delivering more and more of those primary care services. So I would tell you VBC, primary care services, and then expanding that model across other operators. So getting to that M&A activity, doing some larger scale acquisitions so that more people can benefit from this care model that we're really, really proud of.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting that the behavioral health provider bringing in primary versus primary bringing in, you know, behavioral health and substance use disorder providers. So that's a really interesting model.
Yeah, that's right. Because certainly it can go either way. You know, when Suboxone first came out, I know they worked very hard at getting primary care providers to prescribe it. And we kind of saw what the potency of that was. And there's a lot of stigma from providers out there about having substance use disorder patients in their offices. But what I can tell you is there's no shame and stigma at Crossroads. We welcome everyone. So it's a perfect environment to do the inverse. It's just let's welcome folks with SUD and then treat their unmet social needs, their co-occurring mental health issues, which we're already doing. And then let's add more and more physical primary care services as we go along here.
Well, I would love to touch base for future stories on that. It's really interesting. But thank you so much for coming on today and sharing all about Crossroads and what's next.
For sure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Behavioral Health Business Perspective Podcast. I'm Laura Lovett with WTWH Media Chicago.